This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Ball players do it. Hall of Fame hitter Wade Boggs ate chicken every game day. Politicians, too. You can bet Barack Obama will shoot hoops on Election Day. And radio hosts. Tonight, when I get on an airplane, I will knock twice on the fuselage and then twice more when I get off. As we'll hear in a few minutes, almost everybody has a superstition of one sort or another because our brains are wired that way. So whether it's black cats, wishing wells, or a lucky sweater, what is your superstition? And why do you think that way? Our phone number, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And you can join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Later in the program, we conclude our series of final arguments. Today, former Secretary of State Lawrence Eagleburger makes the case for John McCain on foreign policy. But first, superstition and magical thinking. Dana Milbank is national political columnist for the Washington Post, among many other oddities, wrote a piece about politician superstitions. He joins us from a studio at the newspaper. Dana, always good to have you on the program.
Good to join you, Neil.
And John McCain has a lucky friend?
Oh, he has many. In fact, I'm worried he may have shed some of them, which may explain his drop in the polls. But he has a lucky compass, a lucky feather, a lucky penny, a lucky rock, a lucky pen, some lucky shoes, and there's even a lucky lizard.
A lucky lizard.
Yes, I should say at least there had been. He's not as forthcoming about his superstitions this time around, but from his last presidential bid, when things were really tense, one of the members of his traveling entourage would bring out what he called the Spring Hill lizard. It's just not really a lizard. It involves wiggling your pinky. And it was believed that this lizard allowed Texas A&M to beat Nebraska in a very crucial football game and almost got John McCain the nomination back in 2000.
I thought, though, that there was one friend of his who he liked to have with him every election day. I've read about that, but anyway, this is something that politicians seem to be susceptible to. But you also wrote in your piece that, to some degree, it may also be a fighter pilot thing.
That's certainly what McCain thinks. That when he was flying, he would have his navigator clean his visor every time before he took off. I guess that's like you tapping twice
on the airplane
on the fuselage. Perhaps you're a fighter pilot as well.
another life, maybe.
This seems to have followed him into elected office, and it's. They back in his last campaign, they would even have a lucky food. They would make sure everybody ate barbecue on an election day. They'd made sure the candidate watched a movie. That's a little different from Obama's basketball. Mm-hmm. But there was a crisis at one point when he fell asleep, and they were worried he wouldn't get the movie in. But they were able to get the candidate awake and have the movie actually screened, so crisis was averted.
Oh, I was wondering that it turned out to be South Carolina in 2000. people really do believe these things, and John McCain hardly the only politician to think that way.
No, I think it's quite common among the political figures, and Obama has boasted about being superstitious at in campaign rallies, and you played the clip about the basketball. Mm-hmm. The amazing thing is that they're so open about it, and this what they're basically celebrating are pagan rituals in this ostensibly Judeo-Christian nation. You know, forget about calling each other socialists; they should be accusing each other of being pagans.
Now, campaign staffs, I assume they're happy to indulge these little quirks of personality.
Well, of course, and they all bring out their own. There was the McCain aide who would wear his lucky socks with the palm trees on it. I know during this campaign, one of Hillary Clinton's advisors had to wear his rather awful lucky sweater on every election day, regardless of what happened. Others have been known to wear beards until as long as the victory streak kept on going. And quite famously, James Carville would not change his underwear for an extended period of time in the 1992 Clinton campaign.
The lucky sweater, you would wear it even though in some of those primaries, they lost.
Well, superstitions are hard to go by. I mean, perhaps if you renounce the sacred totem or the sacred object, the gods may rise up and punish you for that. So you may want to go with it, you know. I mean, I assume even if you have a bumpy flight, you're still going to tap the fuselage on
Absolutely.
The way out.
Absolutely. It's the charm that keeps the plane in the air. That keeps exactly. it safe. And I've only got one, so I have to take it with me when I go.
Precisely.
Somebody else has to protect the next bunch of clowns that get on that plane. The idea of Election Day itself, a difficult day for politicians after being such frenetic campaigning up until midnight of Election Eve. Then all of a sudden they've got basically nothing to do but the photo op at the polling booth. And then sit around all day and wait.
Yes, they say it's the worst time because there's absolutely, positively nothing you can do. So President Bush always made it a habit of having the workout. That's why you get John McCain's movie viewing or Obama's basketball play. Now, that is not just a superstition. That actually has the legitimate purpose of blowing off steam because these guys have been running, 18 hours a day now for a couple of years.
I have to ask you, Dana Milbank, do you have a superstition?
Well, I'd like to say I've been able to get over the James Carville underwear superstition.
Good.
With lots of counseling and medication, I think it's going just fine.
That's why we don't broadcast an aroma rhyme.
There you have it. No, I've been able to move past these superstitions.
Dana Milbank, thanks very much, as always, for your time today.
My pleasure.
Dana Milbank, national political columnist of The Washington Post. He joined us today from a studio at the paper. His most recent book is Homo Politicus, The Strange and Scary Tribes That Run Our Government. Let's see if we get a caller on the line. This is Freddie. Freddie with us from Cleveland.
How are you today, Neil?
I'm well. Yourself? What's your superstition?
I'm a woodworker. I design and build custom furniture. As I lay in bed the night before before I go to work, I inevitably think about all the dangerous cuts I have to make the next day. And if I picture myself hurting myself, I wrap my knuckles on my headboard, which is obviously made of wood, to the point my wife gets pretty annoyed and tells me to stop and go to sleep. But the only times I've ever hurt myself, I didn't knock on wood the night before, and so far it hasn't failed me.
It sounds like it's more than just one, you know, sort of fat satisfying thump. You rap on it repeatedly?
Well, I have a pretty good imagination. I tend to elaborate a little bit on the things that I have to do the next day.
So you're playing the drum piece from Wipeout on the headboard is what you're trying to tell us.
Well, my wife gets pretty annoyed, but so far it's worked pretty it's worked pretty well. I know knocking on wood is pretty common. I wonder if anybody knows where the knock on wood theory came from.
I think it was a song by Eddie Floyd. But anyway, Freddie, thanks very much for the phone call. Appreciate it.
Have a good one.
Joining us now is Matthew Hudson, a news editor at Psychology Today, who's written an article titled Magical Thinking. Even hardcore skeptics can't help but find sympathy in the fabric of the universe and occasionally try to pull it. He's a news editor at Psychology Today with us from our bureau in New York. Nice to have you on the program today.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And the tapping on the headboard, that would come under the category, I think you'd put it, of a ritual, wouldn't you?
Yes. Humans are very good at spotting patterns. It's how we learn. We naturally see correlations between things, sometimes when they're not there. So if you do something, if you perform an act, knock on wood, carry something in your pocket, and then something good happens, you just naturally make the correlation and assume that there's causation there. And you tend to continue doing the whatever the ritual is in the future.
Because our brain is wired. When we see something, even though there's no link between cause and effect, we make a link.
Yes. And it's even been shown in pigeons. There's a classic study showing so-called superstition in pigeons, where they're in a box and they're fed food and they can't predict when the food is coming. And they associate whatever they're doing, whether it's bopping their head or turning in a circle, with receiving the food. And they think that whatever they were just doing made the food come. And they just build up this elaborate repertoire of these odd behaviors, hoping for more food.
It was B.F. Skinner.
Yeah. And you can understand why McCain would hold, you know, a dozen different good luck charms in his pocket, because he's just sort of associated each one with success.
And why our caller Freddie would say, when I tap on the bedstead, I don't cut myself the next morning.
Exactly.
All right. Let's see if we can get another caller on the line. And let's go now to Samantha. Samantha with us from DeKalb, Illinois.
Hi there.
Hi there.
My superstition is that words have power, so you can jinx yourself. for instance, you know, oh, I hope we're not late today, is precisely when you run into construction.
Yeah, this this ball game seems to be moving right along, guaranteed that there's going to be four pitching changes that inning.
Exactly.
The jinx, Matthew Hudson, where does that come from?
Well, the jinx is a form of tempting fate. So one explanation of it is if things are going well and you comment on it, then it's a form of overconfidence, and fate is going to strike you down as punishment, because we tend to believe in karma. Another explanation is that humans are just very bad at understanding statistics correctly. And so after a string of successes, this string is bound to end at some point. And if you comment on the success and then you fail or something bad happens, you again see a causation there, and you assume that commenting on success causes failure, when in fact failure is bound to happen at some point.
And you write that fundamentally humans are just very uncomfortable with the idea of random actions.
Yes. Being the idea of being at the mercy of a universe that doesn't care about us, that's unpredictable, it's just very, it causes anxiety, it causes stress. And the way that we succeed, the way that we achieve things, is by assuming that we can control things even when we can't, and going out there and trying to manipulate, take control of our lives, take control of the world, manipulate things around us.
And Samantha, we'll ask you please not to say the radio program's going awfully well today.
All right.
Thanks very much for the call. By the way, Matthew Hudson, that thing about knocking on the fuselage of the airplane, does any possibility anybody else in the world does that?
Well, funny you should mention that. That's that was in my article. I started doing that when I was a kid, just sort of touching the outside of the plane with both hands as I stepped on it. So now I still do it whenever I get on an airplane. And I know that it's BS. I know that it doesn't really do anything. But
may this house be safe from tigers is under the same category of prayer.
Yeah.
Thanks very much, Matthew Hudson. Stay with us. We're going to take more calls about superstition. And when we come back after a short break, 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. Here's another one. Turning that radio dial can only bring you bad luck. I'm Neil Conan. Stay with us. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. For Winston Churchill, it was black cats. He thought they brought him good luck. Sports, too, are full of superstition. Turk Wendell, who used to pitch for the Cubs and the Mets, brushed his teeth between innings and always jumped over the foul lines. Today, we want to know, what's your superstition? Our phone number, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Our guest is Matthew Hudson. His article, Magical Thinking, Even Hardcore Skeptics Can't Help But Find Sympathy in the Fabric of the Universe and Occasionally Try to Pull It, ran in Psychology Today. And let's see if we can get another caller on the line. And this is Michael. Michael with us from Portland and Oregon.
Yeah, hi there. I just wanted to comment. I've been a surgical nurse for over 20 years, and I've never known a group of scientifically evidence-based people like surgeons who succumb to superstitions as much as they do. For instance, lucky shoes. I've known surgeons who would not consider doing a surgery without these shoes that have been held together by duct tape for 20 years. And I just think that's a very interesting dichotomy between science and superstition.
Do any of them have lucky scalpels?
No. Scalpels get used once and then go away.
Oh, good. I was gonna ask about that. And Matthew Hudson, the degree of education seems to have nothing to do with it.
Yeah, there have been studies showing that people who consider themselves very rational thinkers are no less susceptible to magical thinking than other people. And there is, in fact, kind of a logic to a lot of these rituals or magical ways of thinking. There are a few different factors that play into it. People tend to think magically more when they're stressed out, or in unpredictable situations, like an election or a baseball game. Also, when the stakes are very high and when the costs of performing the ritual are very low. So let's say a surgeon. A surgeon is, you know, a lot of factors are out of the surgeon's control, and the stakes are very high. It's a life and death situation. And let's say her ritual is just to tap her foot a couple times before going into the operating room. You know, it doesn't cost very much, but it may, the payoff is that it creates peace of mind.
And I think if it creates peace of mind for the surgeon, I think that's all more power to them.
Michael, thanks for the call, and continued good luck to you.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye. This, by the way, from Susan by email. I've been an emergency mental health worker who went to the ER at times to see patients there. No matter how quiet it is in there, you never say it's quiet. The medical staff will yell because it might break the peace. Let's see if we can get another caller on the line. This is Larry. Larry with us from Sheridan, Oregon.
Yeah, Neil, thanks for taking the call. I was in a horrible airline accident some time ago, and after the investigation with the NTSB, they couldn't come up with any cause of the accident, except they did note that there were two distinct knuckle marks right next to the entry door.
There was the plane I'd been on before, yes, indeed. Yeah. So it's, Larry, I'm glad you were very lucky to survive.
Yeah, all good.
Thanks.
Have a wonderful day.
Thanks very much for the call, Larry.
All right, bye.
Let's see if we can go now to Rob. Rob with us from South Bend in Indiana.
Hello.
Hi.
Hey, I was just thinking, you know, I come from a theater background, and obviously I've been around a lot of superstitions, and that, you know, they mention the name of the certain Shakespearean play, but I've never seen a superstition go as far as a friend of mine who is a hardcore Red Sox fan, and he's recently drawn me in, and it's gone as far as, you know, there was a lucky jersey sort of thing that didn't really pan out this year because he didn't go through with it. But it actually, we were actually watching the ALCS this year, and we started drinking one particular brand of beer, and he decided it was that was it, that was the key. So we stuck drinking it, and then the night of the last game, it was my turn to buy, and I, being a skeptic, went out and purposely bought a different brand, which caused him to get in an uproar. And he actually, we live in a dry county in Indiana, or dry state actually, so he actually drove to Michigan to get this particular brand of beer.
And it did not do a lot of good.
It did not. It did not pan out. So I'm not sure how much he's holding on to these still. I think he's still pretty hardcore about it.
There are a lot of baseball fans, and sometimes I confess I do this too. If I'm watching, it affects the game.
Yes, that is a very common thing. That's the idea that of mind over matter. People think that thinking about a game can influence it. So if you picture the success of someone playing, you know, a batter or a free throw shooter, people tend to, if you picture the person's success and then the person succeeds, you tend to draw a connection and feel responsible for it. And this has been shown in laboratory studies with Ivy League students. So I shouldn't feel
like a total idiot.
Exactly.
Okay. Rob also mentioned theater superstitions. We got this from Bill in Indiana. A light is always left on when the house is empty. The ghost light is usually at center stage. Real flowers must never be used on stage as part of the show. It's unlucky for an actress to receive a bouquet of flowers before a performance. It is unlucky for an actor to be actually knitting on stage or on the side of the stage. If a drop curtain is looped, it's a sign of bad luck. Peering from inside the curtain at the audience is also considered bad. Never whistle in a theater, especially backstage. And, of course, you always tell somebody to go out there and break a leg.
It's funny. I was talking to Teller, the silent half of Penn and Teller recently. And he's a hardcore skeptic. And he directed a production of or co-produced a production of Macbeth recently.
Mm-hmm.
And none of the actors wanted to say the name of the play because they felt it was bad luck. So he would say it as much as possible, and he forced everyone else to say it.
And it closed after one night.
No, I actually saw it, and it was a great show.
Rob, thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it.
To counteract saying the name of that show, I did a lot of community theater, and the way to do it was, if someone said the name of it, you had to go outside and walk in a circle and scream every profanity you could think of for a minute in total. And so we had a number of very old women who were very unhappy before the show.
Rob, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's see if we can talk next to, this is Roberto. Roberto with us also from Portland.
Hi, how are you, Neil? Thank you for having me on the show.
I'm very well, thank you.
I was going to comment on, there was an earlier comment about how these are pagan rituals, and coming from a couple of Christian presidential candidates, it's interesting to see that they apply to these pagan rituals. I was wondering a little bit more about that overlap between religion and superstition. I was raised Catholic, and I'm what you would call a Catholic, but I'm somewhat a skeptical Catholic, not somebody who's ever been too much into the whole kind of miraculous aspect of religion. Yet, religiously, no matter what, every time I go on a flight, I do the sign of the cross before going in, and I think it's more of a superstitious reaction than it is a religious reaction. I don't necessarily think that I'm doing it out of a religious motivation, but I do think it's a very superstitious act, but tightly tied to a Christian or a Catholic tradition.
Matthew Hudson, what do you think?
I think there's a back and forth there between superstition and religion. Religion is, a lot of organized religion is sort of an elaboration upon these superstitious ways of thinking that we have. They're culturally ingrained. We learn them. But then they can also feed back to our own personal rituals. You might pick up something like the sign of the cross from culture and then integrate that into your own your own behaviors.
Mm-hmm. Roberto, good luck on your next flight. I hope you're next to me. We can double up.
Maybe I'll start knocking instead of doing the sign of the cross.
Okay, maybe. Bye-bye. Yeah, that's funny. Let's see Andrew. Andrew with us from Cleveland.
Yes. Hi, Neil. I actually have one that, depending on how much I listen and what I've acquired as far as knowledge of your own fandom, you might find interesting. When I go into certain social settings or whenever I start my first day with a new car, I always wear a certain kind of ring. Green Lantern ring.
You've never had a yellow car, then?
No. Red one that got me a lot of tickets, but not a yellow.
No, because, of course, the Green Lantern's ring has no power over the color yellow.
Right. Thank God I don't drive a school bus.
Or waiting for the light to change. It would, you couldn't get the yellow light to...
And also, I wanted to comment, I don't know if your guest has ever heard of this, but there's a funky little board game that was made back in the 60s, I believe, by Milton Bradley, called Superstition. And that's actually where I got my first knowledge of what superstitions were. The don't break the mirror, don't walk under the ladders, stay away from black cats, that kind of thing, because they were all components of this rather elaborate little board game.
Andrew, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Yep.
Have you heard of the game Superstition, Matthew?
I have not played that game, but of course there are Ouija boards. I remember one time in secondary school when people throughout the day started walking up to me and handing me dollar bills. And eventually I figured out what had happened. The night before, they had been playing with the game, and the spirit told them that they would receive good luck if they Each gave me $2,000 or something like that.
Uh-huh.
And then they bargained with the spirit, who was apparently one of my ancestors, bargained her down to like a dollar or two per person.
Your spirit is easily swayed. Yeah.
Kind of a pushover.
I was fascinated by the section of your article that begins after you cite Arthur C. Clarke's famous assertion, any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic.
Right, right. And in a lot of ways... there are a lot of technologies that adhere to types of magic that we read about, like action at a distance. You know, we have remote controls now, or gravity works at a distance. What I found interesting in doing my research is that it seems to me that a lot of these sort of, some people say, pagan ways of thinking, these ancient thought processes might start making even more sense in the future. In virtual worlds and things like this, where you won't have magicians and gods organizing the universe, but you'll have engineers and programmers who can put all these secret laws and back doors into the software, mm-hmm. or into whatever technology that you're using. And if you can discover these secrets that are, you know, they're human implemented, so they sort of adhere to the user's way of thinking. It's like living in a really magical world.
The way Matthew Hudson stated it in his article in Psychology Today is that computer hacks, as solutions or tricks that sidestep normal operating procedures, are a form of coding magic, or as a geek might say, magic is a form of hacking nature. We're talking with Matthew Hudson, the news editor at Psychology Today, about superstition. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. Jennifer did, from Rehoboth in Delaware. I consider myself an intelligent person, but if someone spills salt, I am compelled to throw some over my shoulder. It happened the other day when four of us were out to dinner. After the salt shaker was knocked over, I couldn't think of anything else. I waited a minute or so trying to resist, but then pinched a bit and threw it over my shoulder. The woman next to me, a little further from the salt, leaned in and thanked me. She looked as relieved as I felt. It's funny now, but it was serious at the time. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's see if we get another caller on the line. This is John. John with us from Iowa City in Iowa.
Yes. It just seems to me like with the year now being 2008, and I apologize for tuning in a little bit late here, that this discussion seems to beckon what I think is known within brain science more and more, that all of these type of behaviors are tied to obsession and compulsion.
OCD.
Potentially to the point of the D end of it, yeah.
Okay. Is this connected in any way with obsessive-compulsive behavior, Matthew?
It definitely is. OCD could be considered an extreme form of magical thinking. Thought-action fusion, the idea that if you think a bad thought, then you're especially responsible if the thing happens. There was actually a case study recently where a boy with OCD felt responsible for the 9/11 attacks because he hadn't performed some small thing that he does.
Hmm. Is it possible that all these superstitious and or religious constructs are only human constructs? In terms of the ego, egoism, superego, not to sound overly Freudian.
Paging Dr. Freud.
Yeah.
A lot of them are only seen in humans, but then a lot of them are also seen in other animals. For instance, the superstition in the pigeon.
Hmm. All right, John, thanks very much.
Again, there perhaps just brain science can describe it as a phenomenon unto itself doesn't have to do with the outside of the self.
Okay. John, thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Take care.
Bye-bye. Let's see if we're going to go to Denise. Denise with us from Heber City in Utah.
Hi.
Hi.
Hey, I don't remember where I heard this. I suspect that I remember it came from Gilda Radner. So I've been doing it for years and years, and I got my husband to do it, but on the first of every month, we say the words bunny, bunny, and that's supposed to give us good luck for the entire month.
There have presumably been months in your life where good luck did not rain every day.
Well, sure, but I've actually been doing it for probably a good 10 years, and I you know, I still do it. And then if my husband isn't home on the first, I always make sure to call him. And I just say, did you say it? And he'll go, oh, yeah, I said it.
Okay. Bunny. All right.
Yeah.
Very low risk with that one, as mentioned earlier. Denise, thanks very much for the call. And let's see if we can go to Dennis. Dennis with us in Sacramento in California.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I appreciate it. I was a ramp agent in Atlantic City, New Jersey at a small airport, and the whole touching the plane thing. In that airport, we used to board from outside where they would go upstairs.
Mm-hmm.
A lady, she exited the line, and she went over and touched the fuselage with both her hands, and she shook her head back and forth. She goes, nope, not getting on. So she steps out of line, and she freaks out about like four or five people. So we pull her out of line. Everyone gets on. Plane taxis away, gets on the runway. Comes back on a mechanical.
You're kidding.
Off, and half the people won't get back on the plane again. Crazy stuff.
And on the other hand, I guess flying safely, you'll do anything. It's funny, we got this from Eric in Charlottesville, Virginia. I was stunned to hear your guest tradition of knocking on the fuselage of the plane, getting on and off. This is my biggest superstition in Washington. And here are the headlines from some of the stories we're following today here at NPR News. In Afghanistan, Taliban rebels stormed the country's Ministry of Culture in Kabul today, killing at least five people. The attack was the most brazen in the Afghan capital since last summer's suicide bombing at the Indian Embassy. And a former manager of a kosher slaughterhouse has been arrested in Ohio. A raid this past spring at that same plant resulted in the arrest of 389 people. That was one of the largest immigration busts at a single site in American history. Details on those stories and, of course, much more later today on All Things Considered. Tomorrow, it's Science Friday, and guest host Joe Palca will be here with a closer look at bats, from mysterious die-offs in Northeast caves to blood-sucking vampire bats in the tropics. That's tomorrow's Talk of the Nation, Science Friday. And on Monday, we're going to look back on some of the more memorable moments from the presidential campaign. Email us now with your favorite campaign moments from this election. The address, as always, is talk@npr.org. And now, final arguments. As the presidential election approaches, we've asked four people to make the case for the two major party candidates on foreign and domestic policy. Earlier this week, we heard from Michael Gerson and John McWhorter on domestic issues. Yesterday, Sarah Sewell, senior foreign policy advisor to the Obama campaign, joined us. In a moment, we'll talk with former Secretary of State Lawrence Eagleburger to hear why he supports Senator John McCain on foreign policy. So, McCain supporters, call and make the case for your candidate on foreign policy. Our phone number, 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. You can also post your final argument on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Lawrence Eagleburger was Secretary of State under President George H.W. Bush. He's at a studio on the campus of the University of Virginia in Charlottesville. And Secretary Eagleburger, nice to have you back on the program.
Good to be here. Thank you, sir.
And as you know, the Obama campaign argues a McCain administration would be an extension of the Bush administration. How would President McCain's foreign policy be different from President Bush's, do you think?
In first place, that's an argument that they make all the time, and I should think they'd get off it now. But as far as foreign policy is concerned, there are some places where there would be continuation. Obviously, McCain has indicated he's going to support and continue with regard to Iraq. I know he intends to, in fact, escalate things in Afghanistan because they are not going as well now as they should. But on a number of issues, he's going to be quite different than this administration. For example, he has said, and he means it, that there is a great deal of repair necessary amongst our traditional allies. This administration, the Bush administration, has been far too unilateral and far too prepared to shove things down the throats of our good friends and allies, and McCain doesn't like that, and neither do I. It is wrong, and it's one of the things he clearly intends to change. He has his own views on both Russia and China, which are going to be interesting and, I think, frankly, likely to be a good bit tougher than the Bush administration, at least in terms of Russia, given what's gone on in Georgia. As to China, I don't know enough about. I do know he has some serious questions about China. At the same time, I think he recognizes that there is, with regard to China, a certain degree of doubt in this administration and in the country about what we do, particularly with regard to economic relationships with China. So that the Chinese issue will probably be somewhat different than the Bush administration. On Russia, I would say that I think that McCain would be and will be tougher than the Bush administration has been. on things like aid to aid, if you will, where this administration has been remarkably productive, I might say, and is nobody pays any attention to it, but they've put more money into aid for AIDS than anybody else in a long time. And I would suspect that McCain would follow that through. I should go back on the issue of Darfur, where I think the feeling is that this administration has not been tough enough. I would suspect that for purely humanitarian grounds, if nothing else, the McCain administration would be tougher there and would probably try very hard to bring that thing to the right kind of an end. I could go on, but isn't that that's a fairly good example of, I think, where there will be some things that continue and some things that change. If I can make a point, the opposition, Barack Obama, has been very clear on his willingness, in fact, his desire to get out of Iraq, and as soon as he can. He now has at least backed off from saying get out immediately to saying get out in 16 months, pulling out a brigade every so often until they're down to nothing. And I would suggest to you all that if that policy were followed, what we're going to do is we're going to end up, because we aren't going to win it in Iraq, in my term of winning it, which I can describe in a minute.
Mm-hmm.
But the point is, by doing it, if he does it, if he becomes president and does that, what he now says he's going to do in Iraq, we will be killing GIs throughout that whole period of those 16 months and to no purpose. Because we won't win it at the end. We'll get out. Things will come to a crash in Iraq. And what will have happened is that because of his absurdities, we will be losing American GIs over that 16-month period for no purpose whatsoever. Under those circumstances, I would say we would be better off to get out right now and at least save the lives of those GIs. I think it's wrong to get out, but it's wrong to get out until we have what I would describe as won, and I mean by that where we can leave Iraq in relatively good hands in terms of its own government and where its military is able to take care of itself and particularly prevent the Iranians from doing any damage in Iraq. And that's going to take some time. I think it's been fairly clear that over the last year, let's say, we have done remarkably well in bringing the civilian differences to some sort of a conclusion. But we still have a lot to do. The Iraqi police still have much to learn before they're going to be any good. The military has really come along quite well. So, and beyond that, Obama says he wants to get out of Iraq. At the same time, foolishly, he says he's going to up our commitment in Afghanistan. And if he can't understand that Iraq and Afghanistan are one and the same issue, he's going to take us out of Iraq and he's going to put troops into Afghanistan. He will, first of all, have opened up a flank as far as Iraq is concerned, and it will be, and we will be hanging out by ourselves in Afghanistan. The tactics are wrong. The strategy's wrong. And if I could go on, I could go on for a great time. But my point is purely and simply this in the end. It is an issue of experience versus no experience.
We're talking with former Secretary of State Lawrence Eagleburger making his final argument for John McCain on foreign policy. We're asking for McCain supporters to call us and make their final arguments as well. 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. And Tim is on the line. Tim from Syracuse in New York.
Hi.
Go ahead, please.
Well, my point is that 7 years ago when we got into this war, information was presented to our politicians, and they made decisions based on that information, the best information that we had. Now,
this talk about weapons of mass destruction.
Right, whether it's faulty or not, whatever. But that's what they had at the time to work with. Now, many of them obviously voted to go to war. Obama's big claim is that he was against this war right from the start, and he's saying that that was the right decision. But with the information that they had at the time, it was not the right decision. And that's what I'm worried about, is that he is not going to make the right decisions with the information that he gets.
Are you arguing that we would be better off if one of his arguments is we'd be better off if we hadn't gotten into Iraq in the first place?
Well, I can tell you this. I don't think anyone in this world will miss Saddam Hussein.
I'm not arguing that. I'm
good
saying,
for you.
I'm saying there's a...
And you know, he's got millions of people, you know, to his credit, that he's accountable for. But, of course, no. I mean, obviously, you know, it's been a very difficult thing for us to deal with. But my point is the information at hand. What decisions do you make with the information that you have at hand? And did he have some sort of special information that no one else in the world had?
Well, he was not in the Senate at the time, so maybe he just was skeptical of the information that was there. But in any case, thanks very much for the call, Tim. And let me ask you, Secretary Eagleburg, a question about strategic doctrine, which President Bush changed after 9/11. Obviously, preemption has always been one tool in the bag of military tricks. Every president has had that as an option. President Bush gave it much greater emphasis after 9/11, saying we could no longer wait for dangers to gather. Would President McCain continue that policy with the emphasis on preemptive strikes?
I think, it's a tough one to answer because I'm not sure. I think he would continue the basic policy of being prepared to act against terrorists wherever they are and in preemption. But I think he would be much more careful, if I can gather what I know from him,
mm-hmm.
in the sense that I don't think he would be jumping into every particular issue until he and putting troops into a place until he had looked at the situation well enough to get some sense of how quickly we could get in, get done, and get out, or if there would be heavy losses, whether they would be worth that. And I think the problem in Iraq, for example, even if you accept, as I do, that the administration was acting on the basis of faulty information, but they weren't making it up. But if the fundamental point where the administration went wrong, I think, was once it went in and licked Saddam and got him out of the way, they thought everything was going to be beer and skittles, and in fact it was nothing of the sort, and in fact we were not prepared at that point to put in the troops necessary to make this thing work. And we Americans do that all the time. It's always a mistake. Clinton did that in Somalia, where we put troops in to try to change a government, and then once we got a few of them killed, we pulled out. And that's the worst kind of going into a place and not understanding that you may have to be there for some time and you may have to use a great excess of force in order to succeed. And I think McCain will be more careful in where he applies this sort of military intervention. I have mentioned Darfur. Mm-hmm. I know that's an area that really bothers him greatly for humanitarian reasons. And I think I will say this, I'm reasonably certain that he is of the view that if we have an issue where humanitarian terms make it clear that it is a real violation of the very principles of human conduct, that under those circumstances, I think he will be leaning toward trying to do something about it militarily if necessary. But it will have to rise to the issue of being something that no civilized nation ought to be prepared to accept.
Senator McCain has made the point that he made the same argument to President Reagan about the Marines in Beirut before that went disastrously wrong, and those forces were pulled out too. We're talking with former Secretary of State Lawrence Eagleburger. Final arguments for John McCain on foreign policy. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's go to Craig. Craig on the line with us from Sacramento in California.
Hi, Neil. Thanks for taking the call. Love the show.
Thank you.
I would say the biggest problem I've got with the last 8 years, and I'm a Republican, is that George Bush has always been a divider. This guy, McCain, is a healer. And I think the best way to describe that is one word, two parts. It's Vietnam. I mean, here's a guy who left a lot of his life there, and yet he was the one, in many ways, that led to the reconciliation between the countries and with his many captors. So I think it's time for the country to go with a healer, and this guy's the proven action to put behind it. Obama says a lot of great things along that line, but he hasn't got any experience to show for it.
Secretary Eagleburger, certainly McCain's experience in Vietnam, and Craig is exactly right. Senator McCain did play a large role in the subsequent reconciliation between the United States and the communist regime in Hanoi.
You've got to. One of the things about McCain that I didn't say at the beginning of this thing is, whatever else you say about the man, there's no question he's a hero, and but it, a hero in a way that I think is important. Namely, he stayed in that prison camp when he could have left. He was badly damaged, tortured while he was there, but he's a man of character. And I mean by that, that business in Vietnam showed, I think, that he is a person who, when challenged, will do his damnedest, if necessary, to bring about success, whether it's personal or the U.S. As a country. And it is that character essence of him that I think is terribly important as you try to think about how we will act and react in a world that is, I think, becoming more and more dangerous. And in addition now, with this financial burnout around the world, I think we're in for some very, very difficult times. And I don't think, under the best of circumstances, the opposition presidential candidate would be able to figure out how to handle it.
You mentioned, and Craig, thanks very much for the call, you mentioned, obviously, experience. Are you entirely comfortable with Sarah Palin as the vice president of the United States, that she would be ready to take over in a crisis if she should terribly be called upon to do so?
It's a very good question. I'm being facetious here. Look, I don't, of course not. I don't think at the moment she is prepared to take over the reins of the presidency. I can name for you any number of other vice presidents who were not particularly up to it either. So the question, I think, is can she learn, and would she be tough enough under the circumstances if she were asked to become president? Heaven forbid that that ever takes place. Give her some time in the office, and I think the answer would be she will be adequate. I can't say that she would be a genius in the job, but I think she would be enough to get us through get us through whatever period of time was necessary, and I devoutly hope that it would never be tested.
Let's see if we get one more caller in. This is Leslie. Leslie with us in Panama City in Florida.
Hi. I think that right now the country, more than anything, we need a hero. And I think we have one in John McCain. And I'm one of those swing voters. I live in Florida, and I'm right in that alley. And I feel like it took me a while to come to that point because I feel like both of them are fine gentlemen. But I think for experience, you can't beat John McCain. And it really came down to that because I think that 4 years as a senator is just simply not enough for this kind of a job, especially right now when we have so many challenges in our country.
He was out of the job for at least the better part of 2 years when he was in the Senate. So it's about 2 years of experience in the Senate.
Yeah, I think he's a fine man, and I just think that he needs more time. He needs more seasoning, and I think we have that in John McCain already. Why should we look further when we have somebody who's got all the experience and the character and the brains to do the job? I mean, maybe he's not